Welcome to the deep dive. Looks like we're starting from scratch here, huh? A whole stack of sources on scales and chords and progressions. Music theory 101.
Yeah, you could say that. But hey, everyone starts somewhere, right? And by the end of this deep dive, you'll have a good grasp on these building blocks.
I hope so. I'm excited to see how it all fits together, how these basic elements make the music we love.
Exactly. It's like building a music theory toolkit from the ground up. So where do we begin? The major scales, like the musical alphabet, I guess. But what makes it major?
You're on the right track. It's all about the pattern of whole and half steps between the notes.
Okay, so like in a C major scale.
Perfect example. So we've got C, D, E, F, G, A, B.
Right, the notes of a C major scale.
Now, notice the steps between the notes. It goes whole step, half step, whole, and then half step back to C.
Oh, interesting. So it's not just the notes themselves, it's that specific pattern. You got it. That whole, half pattern, that's what makes it a major scale.
So does that mean you could start a major scale on any note?
Absolutely. That's the beauty of it. Any note can be your starting point, your root note, as long as you follow that pattern.
Makes sense. So how do we get from a scale to chords? I see the sources mention something about harmonizing the major scale.
Ah, yes. Harmonizing. Think of it like adding depth and richness to the scale. Imagine stacking notes from the major scale like building blocks.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
And we use a specific interval called a third to build these stacks. And these stacks, those are our chords.
So we're not just playing the notes one after another anymore. We're playing them together in groups.
Exactly, you're getting it. Let's stick with C major for an example. So start with C, skip D, play E, skip F, play G, boom. You've just built a C major chord.
Wait, so I'm basically playing a chord by playing every other note.
Pretty much. And this one is called a triad because it has three notes. That's wild. I never realized it was that simple. So are there formulas for building chords?
Absolutely. There are patterns for everything in music theory. Like, you might see 1-3-5 to describe a major chord.
What did those numbers mean?
They represent scale degrees. So yeah. The first, third, and fifth notes of the scale. So in C major, 1-3-5 give you C, E, and G, the C major chord.
Okay, I see. But what about minor chords? They sound different, right?
They do. Minor chords often have a bit more of a, I don't know, a sadder or more reflective feel. And their formula is a little different. It's 1-B-3-5.
1-B-3-5. So what's that B3 all about?
That means the third note is lowered by a half step, flatted. So for C minor, you'd play C, E, E flat, and G.
So that one change, that flatted third, that's what makes it minor.
Exactly. It creates that characteristic, darker, more melancholic sound.
Wow. It's amazing how one little change can make such a difference.
Isn't it? And these formulas, they work for any major scale. You just shift them based on your root note. Okay, that makes sense. But why do the sources use Roman numerals to talk about chords? Why so many ways to say the same thing?
Well, think of it as a shortcut, a way to be more efficient. Roman numerals tell us about a chord's function, its role within a key.
Without having to spell out all the notes each time.
Precisely. So in C major, the C major chord is our home base. We call it the tonic. And it's represented by the Roman numeral I.
So the Roman numerals give us a bigger picture. They tell us not just what the chord is, but how it fits in.
You're getting it. Each chord has its own job to do. And that's where chord progressions come in.
Okay, chord progressions. That's where it gets really interesting, right? It's like, how do we take individual chords and turn them into like those sequences that make you tap your foot or want to sing along?
Exactly. It's all about creating movement and tension and release. It's how we make music tell a story. The sources mention this chord progression map. Have you seen that?
I have. It's a little overwhelming, honestly. It's like a roadmap with all these chords and arrows.
I know, right? But it's actually pretty useful once you get the hang of it. It shows you which chords tend to sound good together, kind of like a cheat sheet for creating progressions.
So it's not just randomly picking chords. There's actually a method.
Definitely. And a key thing the map shows is the importance of the tonic chord, the I chord.
Our home base, right?
Exactly. And the tonic can smoothly move to any other chord in the key. It's pretty versatile.
Oh, interesting. So I is like the central hub. And from there, we can branch out in all these different directions.
I like that analogy. But how do we choose the right chords and put them in the right order? How do we make it sound good? Well, that's where the circle of fifths comes in. One of the most important tools in a songwriter's arsenal.
The circle of fifths. Yeah, I saw that in the sources too. It looks kind of intimidating, to be honest. All those keys arranged in a circle.
I know what you mean. It can seem a bit much at first. But trust me, it's an incredibly powerful tool for understanding how chords work together. It's all about the interval of a fifth.
So like moving five notes up or down the scale.
You're on the right track. Moving down by fifths on the circle creates these strong resolutions. It's like a chain reaction, each chord naturally pulling toward the next.
Okay, I think I'm starting to get it. So the circle of fifths helps us create progressions that sound natural, like they're flowing smoothly.
Exactly. And this isn't just some theoretical thing. The circle of fifths is used in tons of songs across genres. Like, think about classic progressions like the 2-5-1.
Oh, yeah. That does sound familiar.
Right. And the 6-2-5-1, they're built around the circle of fifths.
Wow. So I've probably heard this in action without even realizing it.
Probably. It's one of those underlying musical concepts, like a secret code. It's everywhere once you start to hear it.
This is blowing my mind. Yeah. Okay. The sources also mention secondary dominance. What are those all about? They sound kind of intense.
Ah, secondary dominance. Think of them like adding a little spice to your progressions.
Spice. Okay. Tell me more.
They're basically dominant seventh chords. Remember, those have a strong pull toward resolution. But instead of going straight to the tonic, the I chord, they lead to other chords in the progression.
So they create a mini resolution before the final resolution.
Exactly. A little detour that adds complexity and surprise. They create this extra layer of tension and release within the progression.
I'm starting to see how all these pieces fit together to make a song so dynamic. It's like a puzzle, but a musical one.
Exactly. It's all about understanding how these chords relate to each other, how they work together to tell a story.
Okay, before we move on, I have to ask about the three-chord trick. Why is it such a big deal?
Ah, the three-chord trick. Simple but effective. I, IV, and V. Those are your three chords, and you can build a whole progression around them.
So just three chords, and that's enough to create a song.
You'd be surprised how many songs are built on just those three chords. Especially in rock and roll.
So it's all about the relationship between those three chords.
Absolutely. Huh. The I chord establishes home base. The IV leads away, creates some tension. And the V pulls us right back to I, giving us that resolution.
Wow. I never realized how much could be done with just three chords.
It really is remarkable. And it shows just how powerful those basic chord relationships are.
We've covered scales and chords and progressions, the circle of fifths. It's like we're building a musical toolbox.
You're doing great. You've got a good grasp of the harmonic structure of music now. But guess what? We're just getting started.
There's more, but we've already learned so much.
Oh, there's always more to explore in music theory. Like, now that we have this foundation in chord progressions, we can talk about techniques like chord substitution.
Chord substitutions? That sounds interesting.
It's all about swapping out certain chords for others to create variations. You can add some unexpected twists.
Oh, like adding a little bit of your own flavor to a basic progression.
You got it. And it's all based on understanding which chords have similar functions. For instance, did you know that the I, 3, and Vi chords can often be substituted for each other?
The I, 3, and V. So in C major, that would be
C major, E minor, and A minor. We call them the tonic family because they have a similar vibe, a similar stability within the key.
So I could swap out a C major for an A minor in a progression, and it would still work.
Exactly. It might change the feel a bit, but it'll still function harmonically.
Cool. So we can play around with those substitutions within the tonic family. Are there other families of chords, too?
There are. We've also got the subdominant family and the dominant family, each with their own unique roles to play.
Wow, this is like a whole secret language.
It is. The more you learn about music theory, the more you see how interconnected it all is. But before we dive into those other families, let's circle back to something we touched on earlier. Note gravity.
Ah, note gravity. That's the idea that some notes feel like they're drawn to others,
yeah.
Right? Like the seventh note wanting to resolve to the first.
Exactly. And that concept affects both the melody and the harmony. It's all about understanding the natural tension and resolution that exists between different notes.
And that tension and resolution is what makes music so emotionally powerful, right?
You're absolutely right. Think about that pull from the seventh to the first. Like when you move from a V chord to an I chord. It's so satisfying.
That VI cadence. It's like a musical homecoming.
Exactly. It's built into the very structure of the chords, the natural tendencies of those notes.
Wow. It's amazing how it all comes together. I'm starting to realize that there's a reason why certain things sound good together. It's not just random.
That's the essence of music theory. Understanding the principles behind the music, the why behind the what. It's like unlocking the secrets of how it all works.
I'm so glad we're doing this deep dive. I can't wait to learn more about those other chord families. I'm already hearing things differently.
I know, right? It's like a whole new world opens up. We'll explore how those families work together, how they create even more expressive possibilities in music. So we were talking about those other chord families, the subdominant and the dominant. Remember how we talked about the tonic family, how those chords create a sense of stability, like a home base?
Yeah, the I, III, and Vi chords. In C major, that would be C major, E minor, and A minor. All those grounded, resolved kind of chords.
Right. So the subdominant family, well, think of them as the chords that create movement. They lead away from the tonic, introducing a little tension, like setting up the next part of the story.
Oh, interesting. So there would lead us towards those satisfying resolutions back to the tonic.
You got it. Think of it like the rising action in a story, building up the drama.
Okay, I like that analogy. So which chords are in the subdominant family?
Typically, it's the I and the IV chords. So in C major, that would be D minor and F major.
D minor and F major. Okay, so if I were writing a progression and I wanted to move away from C major, maybe create a more tense feeling, I could use D minor or F major to do that.
Exactly. They create a sense of anticipation, leading the listener's ear somewhere, often back to the tonic or towards a dominant chord.
Which brings us to the dominant family. I'm guessing these are the ones that really create that strong pull toward resolution.
You're catching on quickly. The dominant family is all about tension and release. It's like the climax of our musical story.
Okay, so which chords are we talking about here?
Typically the V and the V degree chords. In C major, that's G major and B diminished.
G major and B diminished. And the G major, that's where we get that strong dominant seventh sound, right?
Exactly. That V chord, the G7, it's like a musical magnet, pulling everything toward that satisfying resolution back to the tonic.
Okay, so if I really wanted to emphasize a return to C major, I'd use a G7 to do it.
You got it. It's like a musical exclamation point.
I love these analogies. Okay, so we've got our three families. Tonic, subdominant, and dominant.
Yes.
It's like each one has its own role to play in the story.
I like how you're thinking about it. It's like a musical conversation with each chord contributing something different. Tonic sets the stage, subdominant leads us away, and dominant pulls us back.
Now I want to hear how this works in practice. Can you give us some examples of how these families are used in actual progressions?
Of course. Let's start with a classic, the IIVI. So in C major, that would be D minor, G major, and then back home to C major.
Oh, yeah. I can hear that. It's simple, but it works. It just sounds right.
Exactly. It's a classic for a reason. Now, what if instead of ending on that C major, we substituted a different chord from the tonic family? Let's try an A minor. So it would be D minor, G major, A minor.
That's interesting. It still resolves, but it feels a little different. Kind of melancholic, maybe.
That's a great observation. It's subtle, but that one substitution changes the whole vibe.
Okay, so what if we substituted a chord in the subdominant family? Instead of starting on D minor, what if we used F major?
So we'd have F major, G major, C major.
Yeah, I like it. Still resolves to C major, but starting on F major gives it a different energy, right?
Yeah, it's brighter, more hopeful, like the story is starting in a different place.
Exactly. And that's just by swapping one chord.
Yeah.
Imagine the possibilities. I know, right? This is making me think about chord progressions in a whole new way. Okay, what about those secondary dominants? You mentioned those earlier. How do they fit into all this?
Secondary dominants, they're like the secret weapon. Remember, they're those dominant seventh chords that lead to chords other than the tonic?
Yeah.
Adding a little surprise and complexity.
Yeah, like little mini resolutions within the larger progression.
Precisely. They add another layer of interest. So let's take that IIVI in C major again. But this time, instead of a plain D minor, let's ing it a D7. So D7, G major, C major.
Oh, I hear it. That D7 adds a bit of a kick before it resolves to the G major.
Right. It creates that sense of, wait, where are we going? And then boom, back to G.
So cool. It's like we're adding these little peaks and valleys of tension and release throughout the whole thing.
You're getting it. Secondary dominants are a great way to make your progressions more dynamic, keep the listener engaged.
It's blowing my mind. It's like all these new pathways have opened up.
And that's just the beginning. The more you explore, the more possibilities you'll discover. And the more you understand these concepts, the more you can experiment and find your own unique voice.
This is so cool. I'm starting to see how music theory isn't just about rules. It's about having a set of tools to be creative.
That's a great way to put it. It's like learning the rules of grammar so you can write a poem. You need to understand the structure to express yourself freely.
I love that analogy.
Yeah.
Okay, I have to ask, we've been focusing so much on harmony and chords, but what about rhythm? Doesn't that play a huge role too?
Absolutely. Rhythm is just as important as harmony. It's what gives music its groove and energy.
So when we talk about rhythm in music theory, what are we really talking about?
Well, we often talk about rhythm and meter together. Think of rhythm as the pattern of sounds and silences. It's what makes you tap your foot. Meter is the way we organize those rhythms into recurring patterns.
Okay, so rhythm is the flow, and meter is the structure that organizes that flow.
You got it. Meter gives music its pulse, its heartbeat.
So like a fast, energetic song would have a different meter than a slow, mellow song.
Exactly. The meter can totally change the vibe. A fast tempo and a strong beat can make you want to dance. A slow tempo and a gentle meter can create a calming atmosphere.
So just like with harmony, songwriters can use rhythm and meter to create different feelings and moods.
Absolutely. It's all about using the right tools to express yourself. By understanding rhythm and meter, you can make music that moves people in very specific ways.
Wow, this is really fascinating. I never realized how much thought and intention goes into creating music.
And we're just scratching the surface. There are so many layers to explore.
I'm eager to learn more. What are some of the key concepts and techniques we should delve into when it comes to rhythm?
Well, we could start with time signatures. We've talked about 4/4 time, which is super common, but there are so many other time signatures that can create unique feels and grooves.
Like those crazy time signatures I hear in some progressive rock songs. They're always so complex and interesting.
Exactly. Those are great examples. Time signatures like 78 or 54 can create really unusual rhythmic feels. They challenge our expectations of what a regular beat should sound like.
Okay, so time signatures are one thing to explore. What else?
Well, we can't forget about syncopation. That's a technique that really makes rhythms come alive.
Syncopation. That sounds familiar.
It's basically about placing accents on unexpected beats. Think of funk music or reggae. They're full of syncopation.
Oh, I hear it. It's that offbeat groove that makes you want to move.
Exactly. Syncopation adds complexity and excitement to a rhythm. It plays with your expectations and creates a sense of surprise.
This deep dive has really opened my ears to the world of rhythm. It's like a whole other language within music.
And just like with any language, the more you learn, the more you can express.
This is incredible. I feel like I'm hearing all these details in music that I never noticed before.
That's the beauty of exploring music theory. It gives you a new perspective, a deeper understanding of how music works.
I can't wait to keep learning. What other rhythmic adventures await us on this deep dive?
We've only just begun. We can explore polyrhythms and all sorts of other rhythmic techniques that will expand your musical vocabulary even further.
All right, polyrhythms. You said it's like two drummers playing different rhythms at the same time. How does that even work? Won't it just sound messy?
It's all about how those rhythms interlock. It's about finding a balance between complexity and a sense of unity. Imagine one part is playing a simple 4/4 beat, you know, like a steady pulse.
Okay, got it. A basic 4/4 beat.
And then another part comes in playing a rhythm in 3/4 time over the top of that.
So one is going 1/2/3/4, and the other is going 1/2/3/1/2/3.
Exactly. It might sound a bit strained at first, but if you listen closely, you start to hear how those two rhythms weave together. The accents land in unexpected places. It creates this cool push and pull effect.
I'm trying to imagine it. It's like my brain has to do a little dance to keep up with both rhythms.
It does take some getting used to, but that's what makes polyrhythm so interesting. They challenge our expectations of what a steady beat should be. Think about traditional African drumming, for example.
Oh, wow.
It's often full of polyrhythms with different drummers playing contrasting patterns, and it creates this incredibly rich and textured groove.
I can hear it in my head now. It's like each rhythm has its own distinct voice, but together they create something much bigger.
That's a great way to put it. Polyrhythms add a level of depth and complexity that you wouldn't get with a single rhythm.
This whole deep dive has really changed how I think about rhythm. It's not just about keeping time. It's another way to express yourself musically.
Absolutely. Rhythm, meter, harmony, melody, it all works together.
Before we wrap up, are there any other key rhythm concepts we should touch on?
Well, we could talk about rhythm for hours, but one more thing I'd like to mention is swing.
Swing. Oh, like in jazz music.
Exactly. It's that loose, groovy feel that makes you want to tap your feet.
It's hard to describe, but you know it when you hear it.
Exactly. Swing is about subtly manipulating the timing of the notes. So instead of playing everything perfectly even, you slightly delay certain notes. It creates this laid-back, flowing feel.
It's like bending the rules of the beat a little bit to make it feel more natural, more human.
I like that. It's all about nuance and feel, and it's something that you really have to experience to understand.
Well, this has been an incredible deep dive. I feel like I've gained a whole new understanding and appreciation for the music I love.
And that's what music theory is all about. It gives you the tools to listen more deeply, to understand the how and the why behind the music.
But I guess the real magic comes from taking what you've learned and using it to create something new.
Exactly. Music theory provides a framework, but it's up to you to use those tools to express your own unique musical ideas.
I am definitely feeling inspired. Thank you so much for this amazing deep dive.
It was my pleasure. Keep exploring, keep listening, and keep making music.